On a late night screen, the letters rearrange.
Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So imagine holding, like, a perfect molecular blueprint to cure a fatal disease, but knowing you mathematically just cannot run the clinical trial to prove it works.
Right. Which is, I mean, that's really the paradox of modern rare diseases, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Because when you look at the landscape of global health today, there are around 7,000 known rare diseases.
Which is just a staggering reality.
Yeah.
And if you aggregate all of those individual rare conditions, they actually affect about 6% of the world's population.
Wow, so you are talking about hundreds of millions of people facing conditions that historically medicine has simply ignored.
Exactly, though the science of diagnostics has moved incredibly fast. Today, up to 50% of individuals with a rare disease can actually get a precise molecular diagnosis. A clinician can literally point to your DNA and say, there it is, that exact mutation is causing this condition.
Right. But disease-modifying treatments are available for fewer than 5% of those diseases.
Yeah. Having a name for the disease is fundamentally different from having a weapon against it.
Yeah.
The core issue is that some of these conditions are so ultra-rare, they might only affect a handful of people worldwide.
Or sometimes literally just one person, right?
Exactly. An N of one. And traditional drug development relies on massive clinical trials and huge patient cohorts to prove safety and efficacy. Economically and just mathematically, building a billion-dollar trial for a single patient is impossible.
You cannot run a standard trial for an N of one. But there is a localized, bespoke genetic intervention changing that calculus called antisense oligonucleotides, or ASOs.
Right, ASOs are completely changing the game here.
And to kind of visualize it, think of human DNA as a massive multi-volume manuscript. A genetic error is often just a single typo on one specific page.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So instead of trying to rewrite the whole book or throwing it out entirely, what if we could build a custom find and replace tool for just one specific reader's copy of the book? An ASO acts as a custom-built chemical masking tape. It physically binds to that one specific bad sentence, hiding it from the cellular machinery reading the book.
It's a radically individualized molecular edit. Rather than treating the symptom, you know, you are chemically intervening at the exact site of the RNA transcript before the toxic protein is ever built, or before the vital protein is improperly formed.
Today we celebrate the work of the N1 Collaborative, N1C, and the Patient Identification Working Group, alongside an international group of volunteer assessors who've advanced our understanding of customized genetic therapies.
Yeah, it's really incredible work. In this deep dive, we're covering the open access article titled Consensus Guidelines for Assessing Eligibility of Pathogenic DNA Variants for Antisense Oligonucleotide Treatments. This massive undertaking was led by researchers David Cheery and Marlon C. Laufer.
And just for your reference, this was published by Elsevier, Inc., on behalf of the American Society of Human Genetics in the American Journal of Human Genetics, often referred to as AJHG in 2025.
And to really grasp why their work is so vital, we have to look at the massive gap between possessing a technology and actually applying it safely. Because we have ASOs, right? We know how to manufacture them.
Right.
But how do we systematically determine which of those 7,000 rare diseases, and specifically, which unique genetic typos within them will actually respond to an ASO?
Well, let's unpack the tool itself first, because ASOs are not just a single static type of drug. They're incredibly versatile in how they're delivered to you and how they actually function.
Yeah, the delivery mechanism depends entirely on the tissue affected by the disease. You can deliver them systemically via intravenous or subcutaneous injection.
But for neurological conditions, systemic delivery often fails, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the blood-brain barrier basically blocks the drug.
Exactly. So ASOs can be delivered locally. We're talking about intrathecal injections directly into the spinal fluid to bathe the brain and the spinal cord, or even intraocular injections directly into the eye.
Wow. And because they are essentially small strands of synthetic nucleic acids, they do not last forever in your body. They have a finite half-life.
Right, they eventually degrade. And that finite lifespan requires repeated administration, often every 1 to 4 months.
Which sounds like a drawback, but is it?
Well, in the context of experimental N of one medicine, that is actually a feature, not a bug. If a traditional gene therapy using a viral vector goes wrong, you cannot easily turn it off. The new gene is integrated.
Oh, I see.
But because ASOs wear off, doctors can continuously tailor the dosing regimen or just halt it entirely if you experience adverse side effects.
That makes a lot of sense. The mechanism of action is what really fascinates me, though, because they tackle completely different types of cellular catastrophes.
They really do.
Like, let's say a genetic mutation causes your body to produce a highly toxic protein. A scenario known as a toxic gain of function. How does an ASO stop a factory that is actively pumping out poison?
So in that scenario, the ASO is designed for what we call transcript knockdown. The DNA sends the blueprint to the factory via messenger RNA. The ASO is synthesized to be the exact complementary match to that specific mutant RNA sequence.
What a mirror image.
Exactly. It binds to it, creating a double-stranded molecule that the cell naturally recognizes as abnormal. Then, the cell's own immune defenses, specifically an enzyme called RNase H, swoop in and destroy the bound RNA. The poison blueprint is shredded before the factory can ever read it.
That's wild. So you are basically hijacking the cell's own cleanup crew to target the toxic instructions.
Precisely.
But what happens if the problem isn't a toxic protein, but a vital protein that is suddenly missing, like a loss of function variant where a mutation abruptly truncates the protein, making it totally useless?
Right. So that requires a completely different mechanism, often called exon skipping. Normally, cellular machinery, called the spliceosome, cuts and pastes the raw genetic code, removing the non-coding parts and splicing together the vital exons.
Mm-hmm.
But if a mutation accidentally creates a premature stop sign, the spliceosome halts and the resulting protein is stunted.
Ah, and this is where the masking tape analogy comes in.
Yes. The ASO binds directly over that mutated stop sign. It physically blocks the spliceosome from seeing the error.
So the cell just ignores it.
Yep. The machinery is forced to just skip over that entire faulty exon and stitch the rest of the healthy protein together. The resulting protein might be slightly shorter than normal, but it often retains enough function to save the patient's life.
We also see scenarios of haploinsufficiency where one copy of your gene is completely broken and the other healthy copy just isn't producing enough protein to keep you healthy. It basically isn't pulling its weight.
Exactly. And for haploinsufficiency, you use an ASO to upregulate the healthy wild-type allele. Genes often have natural regulatory elements that act as brakes, slowing down protein production.
And the ASO targets those brakes.
You got it. An ASO can be designed to bind to those regulatory elements on the healthy copy, essentially cutting the brake lines. It forces the single good copy to work overtime to make up the difference for the broken one.
Wow. I mean, if ASOs can act as chemical shredders, molecular masking tape, and cellular accelerants, it sounds like they can do anything.
It really does seem that way.
But surely there's a limit. If ASOs are the customized medicine, how do doctors actually know which genetic typos can be fixed by them? Does every single genetic mutation qualify for this bespoke therapy, or are some fundamentally unfixable with current tech?
That question is the exact crisis this research group set out to solve. Because until the N1C variant guidelines, there was zero international consensus on this.
Really?
Sir, zero. You had brilliant researchers globally looking at genetic data, but every lab used its own internal logic to decide if an ASO might work.
So it was essentially the Wild West of molecular diagnostics.
Mm-hmm.
A variant that a lab in Boston considered fixable might be entirely dismissed by a lab in Toronto just because they were weighting the molecular criteria differently.
Exactly. And the N1 Collaborative realized they desperately needed a standardized, universal framework.
Mm-hmm.
But the real story here is the friction they encountered while building it. They didn't just write a theoretical rulebook and publish it.
Right.
They built it iteratively, confronting the messy reality of biology at each step.
Yeah, looking at how they built this, the internal testing makes a lot of sense. They started with a very tight internal assessment across four sites, right? Leiden, Toronto, Tübingen, and Boston.
Mm-hmm.
They had a single assessor from each site evaluate 30 different variants, but they started with a narrow focus, only looking at loss of function variants to see if exon skipping would work.
Right, but biology is rarely that simple. They immediately hit a wall when they realized a framework that only accounts for exon skipping is virtually useless for a patient suffering from a toxic gain-of-function mutation.
Of course.
So they had to completely rethink the framework to accommodate transcript knockdown and upregulation.
But the jump from internal lab logic to external real-world clinical use is usually where these theoretical frameworks fall apart. How did they stress test the expanded guidelines?
Well, they sent the expanded framework out to external volunteer assessors to test against variants sourced from published literature and massive databases like ClinVar. And they intentionally recruited a really diverse user base.
To see if it was actually intuitive.
Exactly. They wanted to know what happens when you hand this tool to a master's student in Australia versus a senior clinical geneticist in Germany.
And if a volunteer assessor didn't come to the correct conclusion based on the molecular reality of the variant, the working group didn't just blame the user.
No, not at all.
They looked at the discrepancy and realized their phrasing was ambiguous, forcing them to actually refine the flowcharts.
Yeah, that global perspective ensured the tool was functional. But, you know, a static PDF document is incredibly difficult to navigate when you are cross-referencing multiple molecular databases.
Oh, I can imagine.
To solve that, they built an interactive HTML and JavaScript tool called the N1C Variant Eligibility Calculator.
Okay, I actually want to push back on the calculator's real-world utility for a moment.
Sure.
We know what the medical field is like. Clinicians are carrying massive caseloads. They are chronically exhausted. What happens if a clinician using the calculator is rushed and just guesses on the molecular criteria or enters garbage data just to generate a report for a patient?
That's a fair point.
Yeah.
But the developers actively anticipated user fatigue and designed the architecture of the tool to combat it. The calculator employs forced pathway logic.
Meaning what exactly?
It means you physically cannot progress to the next prompt without providing a specific answer derived from external molecular data. It actively forces you to slow down.
But does it prevent a clinician from just selecting yes on a prompt without actually checking the external database?
It mitigates that by requiring highly specific inputs before routing you.
Mm.
For instance, before it even takes you to the relevant flowchart, you have to define the exact variant type. Is it a missense mutation, a stop gain, or a frame shift?
Right.
Depending on that specific input, the entire logic tree shifts. It doesn't just ask, will this work? It asks, based on the transcript structure, what is the distance from the mutation to the nearest splice site?
Oh, wow. You cannot guess that. You have to look it up.
Exactly. Furthermore, they created a suite of 12 training videos on YouTube to explicitly teach clinicians how to perform these complex evaluations.
So imagine you are a clinician sitting in your office. You have spent the hour pulling data from genomic databases, and you run your patient's unique variant through the strict logic of this calculator. The screen doesn't just give you raw data back, it spits out a classification. What are the key findings of this system?
The output is a clear, standardized, 5-tier classification system. Eligible, likely eligible, unlikely eligible, not eligible, and unable to assess.
Let's draw some crucial distinctions here because the word eligible carries a lot of emotional weight for a patient. What exactly makes a variant fully eligible?
The eligible tier is fiercely protected. It is reserved exclusively for variants where there is hard, functional evidence supporting the effectiveness of an ASO approach.
Meaning it's already been tested.
Right. That means clinical or preclinical data already exists. If you are looking at a splice-correcting ASO, eligible means someone has already developed an ASO and proven in a lab that it corrects that specific splice error.
Wait, if eligible strictly requires pre-existing functional evidence, how do we ever get evidence if no one has built the ASO yet? It seems like a patient's variant can never be eligible unless a researcher has already done the expensive groundwork.
You have hit on the exact reason the middle tiers are the most vital part of this entire framework. The catch-22 is precisely why the likely eligible category exists.
Ah.
Likely eligible is the beacon for the research community. It categorizes variants where the molecular criteria strongly suggest an ASO will work, the transcript structure is ideal, the genetic logic is sound, but no one has actually generated the functional evidence yet.
Oh, I see. It's not a dead end. It is a green light for researchers to start experimenting. It basically flags the variant and says, this is a structurally perfect target. Someone needs to build this drug in a lab right now.
Exactly. It prioritizes targets for academic and commercial labs. Conversely, we have the not eligible tier, which means intervention is a molecular impossibility.
Give me an example of a molecular impossibility. If an ASO is just a customized binder, why would it completely fail?
The clearest example involves our masking tape analogy, exon skipping.
Okay.
If you have a mutation on a single exon gene, meaning The entire gene is literally just one continuous sequence without any breaks. You cannot skip the exon.
Because there's nothing to skip to.
Exactly. There is no subsequent healthy section for the spliceosome to jump to. If you apply an ASO to skip a single exon gene, you are just deleting the entire gene, which creates a totally non-functional protein. It fundamentally cannot work.
So the not eligible tier saves immense time and resources, basically preventing labs from chasing impossible cures.
Right, and then unlikely eligible means the molecular criteria suggest an ASO probably won't be effective, but there isn't hard proof directly contradicting it yet. Finally, unable to assess is used when vital data, like the inheritance pattern of the disease, is simply missing from the literature.
Okay, let's step back and look at the real-world clinical implications. Now that we have the ability to categorize these thousands of unique variants into five neat tiers, what does this actually change for you, the patient sitting in a clinic hoping for an answer?
These guidelines serve as the fundamental first step in prioritizing patients for individualized medicine. We finally have a common language to identify which genetic typos are structurally fixable. However, the authors are incredibly careful to note a major clinical limitation.
Which is?
An eligible variant does not automatically equal an eligible person.
It's like having the perfect engineering blueprints for a rescue helicopter. You can run the numbers through a supercomputer, classify the aerodynamic design as fully eligible, and know with absolute molecular certainty that the machine will fly. But you still have to evaluate the weather, the terrain, and the timing before you can actually launch the mission.
That analogy perfectly captures the clinical reality. The molecular blueprint for the ASO might be flawless, but clinicians still have to evaluate the patient's current physical state. What is the stage of the disease? How severe are the symptoms today?
Right, because if a neurodegenerative disease has been progressing for a decade, the brain tissue might be permanently altered.
Precisely. The critical question is whether the neurological or physical damage is actually reversible. If the disease has progressed too far, introducing a perfectly designed ASO might fix the RNA moving forward, but it cannot undo the structural damage already done.
That's heartbreaking, but true.
Yeah. It might not make a meaningful clinical difference to your quality of life, which alters the ethical calculation of administering an experimental drug.
So the variant classification is really just the starting line of a very long clinical marathon, and the science itself is not static. A variant categorized as unlikely eligible today might become a prime target tomorrow if the technology improves. How does this framework prevent itself from becoming obsolete in a year?
Well, the field of ASO therapeutics is moving at breakneck speed. To ensure the tool remains relevant, the Patient Identification Working Group committed to yearly updates of the guidelines.
They have to, right?
They absolutely have to.
Yeah.
Because entirely new classes of ASOs are constantly being invented.
Do we have a recent example of a technological leap that would change a variance tier?
We do, and it is fascinating. The paper highlights a recently developed technology called an allele-selective gapmer ASO. Specifically targeting a gene called GIF1A.
Okay, let's break that down. What exactly is a gapmer structurally?
A gapmer is a chimeric ASO. It is structurally built with a gap of DNA nucleotides in the center, flanked by modified RNA nucleotides on the ends.
Oh, interesting. So what does that specific structure do?
The RNA ends allow it to bind tightly to the target transcript, while the DNA gap in the middle acts as the trigger to recruit that cellular cleanup enzyme we discussed earlier, RNase H, to chop up the target.
Okay, but what makes it allele selective? Because normally if you chop up the RNA for a gene, you are destroying both the mutant copy and the healthy copy, right?
And that is the brilliant part. An allele selective gapmer is engineered with such exquisite precision that it recognizes a single nucleotide difference, a single base pair changed between the mutant allele and the healthy wild-type allele.
Wait, really? Just one base pair?
Just one. It selectively binds to and shreds only the toxic mutant copy, leaving the healthy copy completely untouched to continue producing vital proteins.
That is just incredible.
It is. Innovations like that continuously shatter the boundaries of what is possible, which is exactly why the N1C variant calculator has to be a living document.
We have covered incredible ground today, moving from cellular masking tape to allele selective shredders. Let's distill all of this down. What is the central insight you should take away from this deep dive?
The N1C variant guidelines provide the first international consensus-driven framework to systematically evaluate which genetic variants are suitable for customized ASO therapies. By categorizing variants into a clear 5-tier system, this tool democratizes the ability for clinicians worldwide to identify candidates for life-saving, individualized genetic medicine.
What does this mean for the future of routine clinical practice when diagnosing a rare disease immediately triggers a blueprint for a custom-built cure?
It's a question that is going to define the next decade of genomic medicine.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
On a late night screen, the letters rearrange. One tiny typo and a whole life can change. But we're learning the rules in a language so small to find which threads can answer the call. Not every break can be mended the same. You have to name the mechanism, trace the flame. From splice to skip to turn down the noise. We measure the maybes, we sharpen the choice. 5 tiers of light in the dark of the code. A map for the moments where hope can be owed. Eligible, likely, then we slow the pace. Unlikely, not when the fit's out of place. And when we can't tell, we keep asking why. 'Cause tomorrow's evidence teaches us to try. Rescue on a hard-won road, eligible, likely.